This is a city surrounded by walls. It's about Yerushalayim. The walls of Yerushalayim are certainly famous, but what I want to talk about is how Torah looks at walls. In general, in Judaism, how do we look at walls? Are walls a good thing? Are walls a bad thing? And a little bit of an evidence-based look, as opposed to just kind of generically, so what do you think? Do we like walls or not like them? And look at some of the substance of the issue involved and come around to Yerushalayim and the impact that the walls of Yerushalayim make. So I brought a poem here in number one. And yeah, if you had gone to high school in the U.S., you would for sure know this, and I wouldn't need to put it on the sheet at all. But I'm not sure what's done in Canadian schools. So therefore, I thought I would actually put it a good excerpt on it. No Robert Frost, no Robert Frost.
No, we could also do the
Miles to Go Before I Sleep.
Traveled.
Yes, that like one.
Yeah.
Okay.
In high school, or high school.
High school.
Okay. Well, here's the other famous Frost poem. It's called Mending Wall. And this is just an excerpt from a much longer poem, but I think it gives you enough of a sense of the poem. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. So, walls, what he's saying right now, stone walls outside, between fields, that kind of wall, collapse. Something it is, something there is, as he puts it poetically, doesn't love a wall, but instead tears down the wall separating the fields. That's the image. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill. And on a day, we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. Clear? Right, we can see what what's going on. Neighbors are going to fix the wall between them. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. You've heard that line before? Good fences make good neighbors? That's where it comes from. It's Frost. So, neighbor number one says, you don't need this wall here. You have trees on your side. I have trees on my side. The trees are not a hazard to each other. What's the big deal about just leaving the ground open between the two? But neighbor number two doesn't like that idea. He says, good fences make good neighbors. So it continues. We're still in number one. Spring is the mischief in me. And I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. But he will not go beyond his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Neighbor number one, what do we need a wall for? We need a wall if there are animals that might invade from one side to the other. If there's a fear that someone's a thief, then you need a wall. Otherwise, what's it for? Why are we bothering to put up this wall and every single year we have to go fix it when the winter's over? What's the point? Neighbor number two says, my father always taught me, good fences make good neighbors. So here's my question to you before we see the sources. What would the Torah say? Do we like walls or do we not like walls? Before we get to see the sources on both sides, before we talk about the walls of Yerushalayim. Who's right, neighbor number one or neighbor number two?
Walls.
Go ahead.
Well, we have like walls for mitzvahs, like we like muksa, like so you don't come to use the, like, can't touch the pen, otherwise you might use it, so muksa is like a wall.
Ah, that's an invisible wall. Let's keep the physical walls for the moment.
Okay.
Although you could expand to that, but let's keep the physical walls. Yeah.
We do like walls. We see them in the Beis Hamikdash and in the Mishkan, that there were certain, you know, separations between holy and holier and holiest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could be an example.
Right.
We
use walls to separate places of greater and lesser Kedusha. Definitely true. Yeah. David.
Well, there's a difference to be made between greater places Kedusha on the person and neighbors getting along together. If it's separating, this is my property, this is your property, there's a difference to be made.
Right. Does that make it better for the neighbors to have a distinction of my property, your property, or worse?
It depends on the neighbors.
Depends on the neighbors. Fair enough. So, you know, in the Gemara in Bava Basra, the Mishnah really, in the beginning of Bava Basra, talks about two people who have a yard, and they've been sharing the space in the yard, and one neighbor says, you know what, I'd like to be able to wall off half of it and say, this is going to be mine. And the rule in the Mishnah is that the other fellow has to comply and has to chip in for the wall, assuming the yard is big enough that they could each have sufficient space to do what they need to do. So by default, you can force the other fellow to. But the question fundamentally is, do we want these walls? And we've already seen some evidence in favor. If anybody wants anything to be passed here,
right.
Please,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Send it down.
Otherwise,
yeah.
You may spend like 40 minutes just pointing at something. Okay. So the truth of the matter is that you could argue both ways. You could legitimately argue, as with so many things in Torah, that walls are terrible, destructive, the last thing you want, and you could just easily argue that walls are really important and that you can't have Torah without them. You can make both poles, and what I want to get to is why we have both sides of it. One type of wall that we don't like is seen in the case of Shemitah. Right? We just read about Shemitah in Parshas Behar de Shabbos. The original reference to Shemitah is in Parshas Mishpatim, and in source number 2, I bring you a medrash on the pasuk as it appears in Mishpatim. This is from the Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel. It's halachic medrash. The Torah says, "V'hashviyis tishmetena unetashta." On the seventh, meaning the seventh year, you're supposed to release the field and abandon it. So the medrash says, you know, there are better ways to do Shemitah. You've all heard Divrei Torah about Shemitah, right? So you've doubtless heard somebody say at some point that the goal of Shemitah is to take care of the needy people. Right? You've heard this idea? Are you sure that that's really what Shemitah is about? People say it and it sounds nice. It makes us feel warm and fuzzy. But really, is that what Shemitah is for?
No.
How do you know it's not?
Because that's not the reason that it says in the Torah.
Well, what reason do we get in the Torah?
It just says, like, we have to do Shemitah because God says so. For it to rest.
Sorry? So, well, we get the land resting. That's the land resting is the part about me not working it, but the part about me opening it up to everybody else, the Torah doesn't give a reason. It just says this is what you do, David.
I heard a different reason once that it's about everyone giving, showing that everyone, no matter how much they have mm-hmm. to give, and that way you don't just learn to be a taker.
Right. There's a very big element of generosity that is learned, but you could do Shemitah much better. Meaning the way we do Shemitah, right? The way we're supposed to do Shemitah is we're supposed to say, everybody come into the field. Right? Whoever wants to come in, can come in. You realize that if you have some wealthy guy who wants to get produce, you know what he can do? He can hire a bunch of people, tell all of them to come into the field, let each one take a portion, and then collect it for him. And that's 100% legitimate. And he'll get all the produce. And all the needy people are out of luck, unless they get a job with him. The truth of the matter is that if Shemitah is really about let's help people, then the way it should be done is what this medrash says. What's the goal of this? Why did the Torah say this? Lo sheyochlu asahaniim isn't the goal so that the needy people can eat. So, harei ani machnisa umechalka laaniim. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to harvest my produce, and then I'll give it away. Right? That would be a better way to do Shemitah. And then I can assign it to whoever I think needs. Torah says, no, that's not what you're supposed to do. Talmud Lomar, therefore the Pasuk says, V'hashmi is tishmetena unetashta. In the seventh year, you're supposed to release it and abandon it. Magid sheporeitz bapirtzos. Meaning what you're really supposed to do in Shemitah is knock down the fences. That's what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to just knock holes in your fences. You don't actually have such a halachic obligation, as the Medrash continues to say. Elish gadru chachamim pnei tikun ha'olam. There's a nice little pun there. Gadru chachamim. The chachamim fenced it in. They said, you know what? That's really, we need to improve the world. And what's meant by that, as the commentators to the Medrash explain, is that if you were to knock down all the holes in your fences, the result is people would come into the field from all directions. They would just attack everything, and they would completely ruin your trees. So this way, at least, there's an orderly path of entry into the field. You have your fences, and then you have your entrance. But the point that I want to make here is that Shemitah seems to speak against the fence. We want the fences knocked down. Everybody should be able to enter. I brought you the Rambam here in source number 3, where he makes the same point that really one should one should at least not lock your vineyard and not fence it in the seventh year. The problem fundamentally is that the walls make us less likely to help. Walls keep people out. It's the haves versus the have-nots. And there are any number of stories and passages from the Gemara that you could bring to support this. You remember the classic story of Rabbi Akiva's daughter? Remember the story of Rabbi Akiva's daughter on her wedding day? You've heard the story. It's Gemara at the end of Shabbos. Rabbi Akiva had been told by some astrologer, don't ask you why Rabbi Akiva was listening to astrologers, but Rabbi Akiva had been told by some astrologer that his daughter was going to die on the day she got married. And so he resolved that we're going to keep her indoors. And she's there in the house, and everybody's bustling around, getting ready for the wedding, and she hears a pauper outside, banging, banging, you know, let me have something to eat. And she goes out and gives him food, and then she comes back inside, and they have the wedding, and that night she takes her hairpin and stabs it into the wall, and the next morning she sees that it was stabbed through the eye of a snake. The idea is Tzedaka tatzel mimavis, her Tzedaka saved her. There are numerous questions you could ask about this story. Like, you know, should she have gone out if they warned her she's going to die that day, and so on and so forth. But why couldn't everybody hear? Because there's a wall in between, and they're all busy with their business and not noticing what's going on the outside. Walls separate the haves from the have-nots, and they make us less likely to help. That's one way in which a wall is bad. A second way comes from this past week's parsha and the law of Batei Arechoma. Anyone know what the law of Batei Arechoma is? See how well you reviewed parsha this week. Okay. Good. My opportunity to teach something. The rule is that in Israel you have two different types of properties. You have properties that are inside of walled cities, and then you have properties that are either fields or houses in unwalled areas. And they have opposite rules in terms of sale. You sell a field in Israel, every 50th year, the Yovel year, the field comes back into your family. Selling a field is essentially a rental. It's an up to 50-year rental, depending on how many years remain, until Yovel. The rule is, if I sell my field this year, for 2 years, I can't buy it back. After that, I can go to the person who bought the field for me and say, I want it back. Now refund the rest of the purchase based on the number of years remaining on the deal, and then I get the field back. That's the way it works in fields, open areas. Houses in walled cities are the opposite. If you have a house in a walled city meaning it was a walled city originally when we first entered the land, then the rule is that I have 1 year to buy it back. No questions asked. I can go to the person who bought the field, give him back the money, case closed. After that year is over, it's gone. I'm never going to see it again. It doesn't come back to me in Yovel, doesn't come back to me, I can buy it, just like anybody can, but that's about it. So it's the exact opposite rule. That was what was stated in the parsha this week. So Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch offers an intriguing explanation for why the Torah does this. Why is it when it comes to fields, the Torah says that the land goes back always into the family. When it comes to walled cities, the land stays with whoever buys it. You don't get to establish this kind of family estate the way you do with fields. Take a look at number 4. He says, for clearly these laws establish the greatest possible upkeep of an urban population occupied with agriculture as the predominant fundamental characteristic type of the nation. It places an obstacle to the growth of large cities at the expense of the surrounding country, which otherwise is so very prevalent. By the way that the houses in the country towns were protected like the land itself from permanent sale, and in Yovel reverted to the original owners or their heirs, provision was made that on the whole, town and land remained in connection as family property. So that as a rule, every field and every vineyard would have as its proprietor a household in the neighboring town. In other words, the way it works is there's a permanence to the fields and to the towns that are adjacent to the fields, the open towns, not the ones that are walled in. So if I have a field and I have a house right there so that I can work the field easily, My kids are going to have it. My grandkids are going to have it. There's a desire for Jews to be involved with agriculture. And number five, he gives you, Rosh Hashanah Hirsch, gives you an explanation about why he loves farming and why he believes that it's so important to farm. He says, the great advances in the development of culture have been stimulated by agriculture, and a great part of the inventions and arts have been evoked by it. He loves agriculture. Rosh Hashanah Rafal Hirsch would like to see all of us become farmers. Although he has a cautionary note after that, he says it also can bring you down to the level of the land. There are negatives in farming as well. But his point is that when we build walls, they separate us from nature. It's about the urbanization of society. There's a lot to be said about this. For example, why did Adam and Chava eat from the fruit of the tree? Why did they eat from the fruit in Gan Eden?
Because they were told not to.
Well,
reverse psychology.
If God had said, eat from this tree, maybe if he hadn't stuck it in the middle of the garden and made it attractive, that would have been a good way to prevent the problem. What should they have been doing instead of hanging out next to this tree? What did Hashem tell them to do?
Pull the plants around the tree.
Sorry?
Eat from everything else.
Eat from everything else, and he told them, Peru Revu, bear fruit and multiply, Umil Ues Haaretz, and fill the land. They're not supposed to stay in the garden. They were supposed to be out there roaming. Yeah, you can come back to the garden to sleep at night, but they're supposed to be out there roaming, developing the world. The fact that they stayed in the garden is what leads them to eat from the fruit. If they had done what they were supposed to do, they wouldn't have been there next to the tree. That's not my fetish. There's a fellow who wrote this in an article in a journal in Israel called Megadim. I think he was right on. But the field fundamentally is a place for human creativity, and the wall makes us stagnate. It fences us off so that we're not out there working the land. You follow? So that's a second negative. And then the third negative is the wall that makes us overconfident in terms of our defenses. Take a look at number six, please. This is from the Tochacha and Parshas Kisavo. This week's Parsha, in Parshas Bechukosai, we had one Tochacha, one warning of punishment for what's going to happen if we don't keep the Brit, if we don't keep our covenant with Hashem. So there's a second warning, which is much more harsh, that appears in Parshas Kisavo, and that includes this pasuk in source number 6. Ve'itzar l'chol b'chol she'arecha. Hashem is going to besiege you at all of your gates. Ad redes chamosecha ha'gvohos v'habitzuros ha'sharata boteach bahin b'chol artzecha. Until all of these high, reinforced walls in which you place your trust, until they all collapse. You have too much confidence in your walls. What does that remind you of from Tanakh?
Yericho.
The very first conquest we had in the land was Yericho. How do we conquer Yericho? What happens? You know. The walls, right? The walls come tumbling down, right? On the spot. There are a million ways Hashem could defeat Yericho, right? That's the only time that he uses this method of having the walls just collapse in place. Why? Because the very first battle, he wants to set a tone and to say, you can't trust your walls. Don't believe that this is going to protect you. That doesn't mean we don't build them. Let me make this very clear. This is not an anti-fence polemic. The security fence is necessary. But you can't trust your wall. Take a look at number 7. This is a classic. In Parashat Shlach, when we send the Meraglim, right? We send the spies into the land.
The ones that have fences, it means that they're vulnerable, and then the ones that don't have them.
Precisely. Good. The one of the questions they ask, the Meraglim ask, is Habamachanim im b'mivtzarim. Are they living in camps, meaning walled-in camps? I'm sorry, open camps, or are they living in mivtzarim, in walled-in fortresses? Says the Medrash, if they're living in an open camp, that means they're not afraid. If they're living inside walls, that means that they're weak and they need to rely on the walls for their defense. Within this, the idea is that the wall is a sign of weakness. It's something that we come to put our trust in inappropriately. Take a look at source number 8, Pasuk in Zechariah, prediction for the future. He says, Prazot teshev Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim will be prazot. Prezot, open areas like Prezim in Megillas Esther. The Yerushalayim is going to be wide open, Merov Adam Ubeima Betocha, because you are going to have so many people and so many animals that it's going to expand. Right? Sound familiar? Yerushalayim, we've seen that with Yerushalayim in our own day, the expansion of Yerushalayim. But he predicts that Yerushalayim is going to be an open city without any fear. So based on what we've said so far, we have three reasons not to like walls. They separate the haves from the have-nots, as in the Shemitah case. They separate urban life from agriculture, as seen in Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch's comments. And they separate us from our enemies, which in and of itself is a good thing, but they give us a sense of confidence that doesn't necessarily belong. So we have three reasons not to like walls. But like I said in the beginning, for everything that appears in the Torah as a negative, you could also find room to argue that it's a positive. You can't make it a one-sided thing. Here we go back to something that was mentioned before when we start to talk about the positive side of walls. Take a look at the Rambam. I brought you in number 9. The Rambam is talking about the laws for construction of the Beis HaMikdash, and he says, "Ve'elu eina devarim shein ikar b'binyan habayis." The following elements are the essence when it comes to the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. Osin bo kodesh. The Kodesh HaKadoshim, you make a space called a Kodesh, with a Kodesh HaKadoshim within it. V'yiyah lifnei HaKodesh, makom echad v'lo nikra ulam, you have a place in front of the Kodesh, that's called the ulam. Ushloshta nikra and heichal, and all three together, ulam, heichal, Kodesh HaKadoshim are called the heichal altogether. You may be familiar with the heichal because it's the room in the Beis HaMikdash that has the shulchan, the table with the bread. It's where the menorah is. That's the heichal, and it has the Kodesh HaKadoshim. All the best parts of the Beis HaMikdash are there inside the heichal. But then he writes, "Va'osin mechitza acheres saviv laheichal." You make a wall around the heichal, rechoka mimenu, at a distance from it, kein kalei achatzir shayu b'midbar, like the walls that went around the Mishkan in the Midbar. V'chol amukaf b'mechitza zu, anything that is surrounded by this wall, shu kein chatzar ohel moed, that's like the yard of the ohel moed, hu anikra azara, that's called the azara, that's the outer room of the Beis HaMikdash. V'chol nikra mikdash, and together it's all called mikdash, and the emphasis that I want to make here is, you have all these different spaces defined by walls. And what we learn is, and Rav Soloveitchik spoke about this at length, is that the walls are what create the Kedusha. It's what's called in halachic terminology, Kedushat Mechitzot. It is the sanctity created by having these dividers. There's a kina which was said every year on Tisha B'Av until this past year, the kina of Ahali Asher Konanta, which describes the universe as a series of oholot, or oholim, depending on how you say it. But a series of ohalim, and ohel is a tent. So it describes the universe as an ohel, but then it describes smaller spaces as ohalim, going down to the Beis HaMikdash, and it talks about, here's the key line in source number 10, ohali, my tent, God says, Asher Chanisam, I'm sorry, this is actually my tent, the Jews say, Asher Chanisam Eaz B'Ta'av, in which you, God, you camped in its Ta'ot. What is a Ta? Taf Aleph in Hebrew. What are Ta'im? A cell, right. In modern Hebrew, Ta is a cell. It's a space that has some kind of a wall around it. It could be a closet, it could be a cubby. You could use it in different ways. But it's talking about the ta'im inside of the Mishkan and inside the Beis HaMikdash, which all had their own kedusha, their own holiness, as defined by the wall that surrounded it. I made a big deal about Yerushalayim being an open city in the future in the Pasuk in Zechariah. However, you can look at the very next pasuk in Zechariah, which I brought you in, source number 11, right? If you go back to number 8, you see it's chapter 2, sentence 8. This one is chapter 2, sentence 9. In which Hashem says, "Vani ehyelah ne'um Hashem, I will be for Yerushalayim, chomas eish saviv, a wall of fire around it." So much for not liking walls. Hashem gets to be the wall. And we use walls for our mitzvahs. Which mitzvahs involve a wall?
lot.
Sorry?
Lot.
Give me one.
Mechitza.
Okay. Mechitza for davening? I have to admit, I didn't even think of that one.
Sukkah?
Sukkah?
Kind of.
On the doorpost. Yeah. Well, that's sort of the, what thwarts the wall, right?
So you need the wall in order to have the doorpost.
That's true. Sorry? Chuppah is walled, right? The way we do a chuppah today is not. Right? The way we do a chuppah today, there are no walls. It's just the roof on the top, largely because the videographer would be very, very upset if he had no access. But historically, what a chuppah was, if you go back to the times of the Gemara, was a canopy. It actually hung down to give privacy inside. The idea of the wall in these mitzvos, maybe with the mezuzah, but certainly with the sukkah case, the chuppah case, not sure what to do with the davening one, you can make the argument there as well, is that it unifies those who are inside as being part of a set population that has joined together. Right? When you make a bracha on food, you can make a bracha on food for others who are within that same space, inside the walls, with you. So here, we see walls as a very positive thing. They create kedusha, they unify those who are inside. It's beautiful to have walls. So which is it? Is neighbor one right, or is neighbor two right, or is this going to be a cop-out and say, well, you're both right? They're not both right. They're not both right. It's all about the nature of what the wall is there for. And in order to introduce this, I wanted to talk to you about a psychological study that was done in the 1940s involving a couple of Jewish psychologists, naturally. The source number 12 is from the arbiter of all knowledge, Wikipedia. And it involves something which is called propinquity, which just rolls off the tongue. You can't, once you know that word, you just can't stop saying it. It'll make its way into your conversations, and people will think you're very sophisticated. The propinquity effect is the tendency for people to form friendships or romantic relationships with those whom they encounter often, forming a bond between subject and friend. Occupational propinquity, based on a person's career, is also commonly seen as a factor in marriage selection. Workplace interactions are frequent, and this frequent interaction is often a key indicator as to why close relationships can readily form in this type of environment. In other words, the more you see somebody, the more apt you are to form a friendship with that person. In other words, relationships tend to form between those who have a high propinquity. It was first theorized by psychologists Leon Festinger, Stanley Schachter, and Kurt Back in what came to be called the Westgate Studies, conducted at MIT and published in 1950. So what were these Westgate Studies? Take a look at number 13. Festinger and his colleagues approached, two of them, by the way, I think also were originally from U of T. I'm not sure of that, but I seem to remember reading that. Anyway, Festinger and his colleagues approached the students some months after they had moved into Westgate West, that's their dorm, and asked them to list their three closest friends. The results were fascinating, and they had very little to do with values, beliefs, and attitudes. 42% of the responses were direct neighbors. So the resident of apartment 7 was quite likely to list the residents of apartment 6 and 8 as friends, and less likely to list the residents of apartments 9 and 10. Even more striking, the lucky residents of apartments 1 and 5 turned out to be the most popular, not because they happened to be kinder or more interesting, but because they happened to live at the bottom of the staircase that their upstairs neighbors were forced to use to reach the building's second floor. Some of these accidental interactions fizzled, of course. But in contrast to the isolated residents of apartments 2 and 4, those in apartments 1 and 5 had a better chance of meeting one or two kindred spirits. The more interactions you have, the more likely that you will encounter people whom you like, and that they will stick because you see them frequently. That's the idea here that they're establishing. Half a century passed. The Westgate West message began to infiltrate office culture. Steve Jobs famously redesigned the offices at Pixar, which originally housed computer scientists in one building, animators in a second building, and executives and editors in a third. Jobs recognized that separating these groups, each with its own culture and approach to problem solving, discouraged them from sharing ideas and solutions. Perhaps the animators could introduce a fresh perspective when the computer scientists became stuck, and maybe the executives would learn more about the nuts and bolts of the business if they occasionally met an animator in the office kitchen, or a computer scientist at the water cooler. Jobs ultimately succeeded in creating a single cavernous office that housed the entire Pixar team, and John Lasseter, Pixar's chief creative officer, declared that he had, quote, never seen a building that promoted collaboration and creativity as well as this one. You want people to have exposure to each other and not have to deal with the walls in between them. That's the idea. Clear? So what this means to me, and what I draw from this, is that there are really two kinds of walls in Torah. Now, I am oversimplifying by saying this, and I recognize that that's true, but I'll account for it as we go through this. But there are two fundamental kinds of walls. There is the exclusive wall, and there's the inclusive wall. Fireworks. They know it's raining, right? Okay. Okay. The exclusive wall is the wall that is around the field, right? It's meant to exclude. It's meant to obstruct. It locks out those who are needy. It's the wall that separates the city from nature. It's the wall that provides defense that makes you overconfident. And that's the wall that the Torah would demolish. On the other hand, there is the inclusive wall. The inclusive wall creates this kind of collaborative closeness. It creates an intimacy. It enhances this propinquity for those who are within. Now, you know, again, I don't mean to oversimplify it. The reality is, any wall you build is by definition both inclusive and exclusive. Don't kid yourself. Any wall that is saying, okay, we're the club, so we're together, is saying that those who are outside of the wall are not the club. But the question is, what's your focus? Is your focus, I want to keep them out? Or is your focus, I want to create a space that we can share? That's really what it's about. We want walls that are designed with a focus of inclusivity. You know, as Jews, we identify ourselves as part of a nation, as part of a community, as part of a team. We have a shared set of goals, and we want to promote that shared identity and cohesion, and so we build walls that will encircle and identify our team. It's designed to include, to embrace, and to envelop. That's a great wall. You could apply it to Eruv. You could apply it to all sorts of different walls. You could apply it to the walls of the sukkah. Yeah, I brought you the pasuk in number 14 about being alone with Hashem, where Micha tells you there are three things that Hashem wants of you: asod mishpat, to perform justice; avach chesed, to love kindness; v'atznei alechet im elokecha, and to walk privately with Hashem. The idea of being alone with, that's what the walls of the sukkah do. They isolate the couple exclusively for each other. And then that brings us to Yerushalayim. The walls of Yerushalayim are supposed to be these positive walls. They demarcate what is called in Halacha Machaneh Yisrael. When we lived in the Midbar, right, on our way from Egypt into Israel. So we traveled, what do you want? We traveled with three camps. You had the Mishkan, that's called Machane Shechina. Then outside of that, you had Shevet Levi. They camped around it. That's Machane Leviyah. And then the rest of the Jewish people are Machane Shlishi, or Machane Yisrael. We come to Yerushalayim. Har HaBayit has the Har HaBayit has the status of, one second, am I going to get it wrong? Beis HaMikdash has the status of Machane Shechina. That's the innermost one. Har HaBayit is Machane Leviyah. And then you have Yerushalayim. And that's the third Machane. That's this Machane Shlishi, parallel to where we lived when we were in the Midbar. That's where we get Machane Yisrael, which is invested in Kedusha and holiness by those walls. The walls of Yerushalayim are certainly protective, you know, but they're meant to look at them as inclusive. The wall of Yerushalayim is not meant to exclude Beit Lechem. It's not meant to exclude Hebron. It's meant to encircle the people who are within, Jews of all ages, Jews of all ethnicities, it's for us to be together. And they're large enough to embrace everybody. Remember the classic Mishnah in Pirkei Avot? Right? What was the nes in Yerushalayim? We're told about the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot lists 10 miracles that are associated with the Beis HaMikdash, but they're not. Only 8 of them are Beis HaMikdash, 2 of them are Yerushalayim. One of them is that snakes and scorpions never harmed anybody in Yerushalayim. And the other is, Lo Amar Adam Me'olam, Tzar Li HaMakom Asher Alin Sham B'Yerushalayim. Nobody ever said, there's no room for me in Yerushalayim. There's always room for us in Yerushalayim. There's no such thing as not having space. I like the line of the Chatam Sofer. Did I bring it on here? No, I didn't bring it on the page. Why didn't I bring it on the page? It's got to be in my notes. I'll tell it to you. The Chasam Sofer said the reason why, he said, what you have to look at in terms of the miracle there, the line doesn't say there was always room for everybody in Yerushalayim. The miracle was that nobody ever said, there's no room for me in Yerushalayim. People were so happy to be there, close to Hashem, that they were just thrilled to be there, and it didn't matter how narrow the space was. It didn't matter how little room there was. That's the beauty of Yerushalayim, and as a matter of fact, it's something which the Chachamim worked to expand. Anybody know what a chaver is? Don't say friend. The technical meaning of the word chaver.
Philosopher.
So it's funny. You're thinking of the Kuzari and the Chaber. Yes. There is the use of the word Chaver in that sense as a philosopher. You are correct. The Chaver in the Gemara refers to somebody who accepts upon themselves that they are going to follow the Torah standards for separating Truma and Maaser and for Tuma and Tahara, purity and impurity. So that is a general rule. If I know somebody is a chaver and they give me produce, I can assume it's already tithed and I can assume it's all pure and I don't need to worry. Generally speaking, the Jewish population was split into three different groups. You had a chaver on the one hand, who you knew you could always trust. You had the amaharis on the other hand, who you had to assume you couldn't trust. And then in the middle, you had all the people who, I don't know, maybe, can I eat there? I think I can eat there. I'm not really sure. Let me ask my rabbi. Well, he's not going to tell me either. That's generally speaking what would happen. Think about this now. Aliyah L'Regel, 3 times a year, Jews from everywhere converge on Yerushalayim. That could have been the most beautiful thing in the world, or it could have been the biggest nightmare. Can you imagine? We converge on Yerushalayim together. I'm walking in the street. I bump into somebody else by accident. I'm worried. Did I just become Tameh? He's worried. Did he just become Tameh? He doesn't know me from anybody. I don't know him from anybody. How do we know what standards we're each keeping? You don't know. I go to the store. Was Truma and Maaser separated? Oh, yes. Rabbi Schwartz says that it was separate. Well, who's he? I don't know. I just came from, somewhere far away, and I just came for Aliyah L'Regel. I don't know what the Hashgachot here are. Right, Ben Yosef said this was fine. Right, Ben Yosef, that sounds like a Sephardi name. Do I trust him? Do I not trust him? What do I know? I don't know anything. What did the Chachamim do? They said, when you get to Aliyah L'Regel, when you get to Yom Tov, all the rules are off. Everybody is assumed to be Tahor, and everybody's produce is assumed to be tithed. Trumot and Masrot are separated. No matter what. Doesn't make a difference. Ad kidei kach, that if today is the last day of Yom Tov, right? Today is day 7. I ask him about it, I touch him, whatever it is, I'm Tahor, everything is fine. 24 hours later, it's not fine. 24 hours later, the same person, I'm now Tameh if I touch him because I don't know what his standards are. But for Yom Tov, they said, we're going to make sure that everybody will be fine. Take a look at source number 15. The Maariv Chiyus comments on this, on the Gemara Nida, which talks about this. He says, Gadol ha-pirud b'mesha adam monea atzmo lechol etzel Yisrael chaveiro. He says, the division caused is great when a person abstains from eating with his Jewish friend. I'm going to keep going back and forth between Ashkenaz and Sfarad because I have Elkanah over here and I'm thinking I have to read in Sfarad and everybody else in Ashkenaz. Yeah. Sorry? Okay. Yeah, but you still speak Hebrew correctly and therefore it should be done in the proper Miftah. So he says it's terrible if someone is not going to be credible for Trumot Ma'asrot, if someone is not going to be credible for Tuman Tahara. V'lolachinam am Rabbi Akiva. He says, you want to know what Rabbi Akiva said? It's reported in the Gemara. It's a Gemara. Rabbi Akiva used to say, when he was in Am Haaretz, before he started learning, Mi yiten li tamar chacham v'aneshchenu kachamor. Show me a Torah scholar and I'll bite him like a donkey. And the Gemara actually is stronger than that. The Gemara says, the Rabbi Akiva said, and not just any donkey, but a white donkey. Because apparently that white donkey, it breaks bones when it bites. Why? Because there was antagonism about, he doesn't trust me. He doesn't think that my food is good enough for him. He says the main purpose of Aliyah LaRegel was supposed to be to join people to each other. But you ain't going to get there. If they're not credible when it comes to Tumah and Tahara. So they said, you know what? We are going to come up with a plan to prevent this all from being ruined. They made all Israel into chaverim at the time of Yom Tov. They are credible for their wine, for their oil, so everybody is able to eat together. At that point, that was the gzeret derabanan. Increasing love and increasing joining between people. That's what they did. They said the walls of Yerushalayim are meant to include everybody together. That's the wall that Yerushalayim will tolerate. That's the wall that Zechariah wants. The Chomas Eish Saviv is the wall that makes us one population there within Yerushalayim. There's much more to be said about this in terms of Yerushalayim and its walls and the Kedusha they create. That'll be for another time. But it's not a statement that there are no differences between Jews. There are. We have different approaches to things. We do things differently. People have different standards for whatever their reasons in their personal lives. But at the same time, that can't keep us from viewing ourselves as one nation. You can't. That's the type of wall that we want. Again, as I said before, and I said it in the beginning, this is a simplification. In the end, we need the negative walls also. Because after all, we need walls for defense. Yeah, we may not want to come to trust our walls, but if you don't have a wall, then there would be no one left to trust anything. Realistically, there are times when you need that kind of a wall. And you even need that kind of a wall between Jews at times. Right? If the Chachamim wanted to say that we should abolish all differences, they wouldn't have stopped at the time of Aliyah LaRegel. They would have said, you can trust people all year long for their Truma and the Maaseh. You can trust people all year long for Tumah and Tahara. They didn't say that. There is an understanding that there are differences. But you have to, so to speak, draw a line somewhere. The line also being a wall, I suppose. But you have to draw a line somewhere and say, now we recognize that we are one and that we are and that we're unified. Funny story, realizing that I'm the oldest person in the room, I don't know how familiar this will be for you, but that's life. You're familiar that there was this thing called the Berlin Wall, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. There was an East Berlin, there was a West Berlin. Okay. You've heard of Ronald Reagan. Okay. So in 1987, communism is sort of teetering, getting towards the end, and Reagan goes to West Berlin, and he stands in front of the Berlin Wall, and he makes rousing speech, and he's standing in front of the wall, and he proclaims, Mr. Gorbachev, who was at the time the head of the Soviet Union, Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And that was like a lightning moment. Everybody knew that speech. Everybody saw that. I mean, I was a teenager, but I was familiar with it. And then just a couple of years later, the wall came down. But that line almost didn't happen. The speechwriter was a fellow by the name of Peter Robinson. So he gave an interview years later, and he told the story behind that line in the speech. Reagan wanted the line in, but the diplomats were really nervous And they said, you know what? Don't offend anybody. The Germans have gotten used to having this wall here. No one thinks about it anymore. It's been here for decades. Don't say anything. Take the line out. So Robinson, the night before the speech, goes to dinner with a bunch of local residents. And he asks them, have you gotten used to the wall? And they said, absolutely not. And so he left the line in the speech. Reagan said it, and the rest is history. You know, with the laws of Shemitah and the walled cities, right, in which we are told that Hashem wants the wall broken down to give access, where we're told that you're not supposed to wall yourself off from agriculture. With the warning of the Tochacha about having confidence in our defenses, the Torah teaches us to tear down the wall that divides. But with the Sukkah and with the Chuppah, with the Eruv, with Yerushalayim, the Torah teaches us to build up that wall of propinquity that will encircle and will envelop, that will create this shared identity and community. That's the beauty of the walls of Yerushalayim. May we see Hashem rebuild these walls with fire. May we see Hashem rebuild these walls now. And may we view it not by live stream on our phones from Toronto, but live in person on the inside.